Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Okay, so we'll continue in this section of the Vedana Anupassana Tetrad in the Anapanasati Sutta. And yesterday there were descriptions and tools for working with piti, with rapture, and today's reading begins with sukha, so that's the sixth step of the Anapanasati Sutta. Breathing in, experiencing pleasure; breathing out, experiencing pleasure, experiencing sukha. Sukha, the word translated as pleasure in step six, is the opposite of dukkha, stress or suffering. And like dukkha, it has a wide range of meanings. These include pleasure, ease, bliss, well-being, and happiness. In general, sukha can cover both physical pleasure and mental pleasure, although there are cases, such as in the third jhana, where the mind is equanimous while sensing pleasure with the body. In cases like this, sukha is reserved for the physical pleasure, whereas mental pleasure is allotted a separate word, joy, somanasa. And that has its opposite as well, domanasa. Somanasa, domanasa, dukkha, sukha. In the standard similes for the jhanas, pleasure is represented by water. The water being kneaded into the ball of bath powder in the simile for the first jhana, the water of the cool spring filling the lake in the simile for the second, and the cool water permeating the submerged lotuses in the simile for the third. Only in the fourth jhana, where pleasure is totally replaced by equanimity, does water disappear from the simile. Because pleasure, like rapture, can be either physical or mental, or both, and because there is such a thing as pleasure more not of the flesh than not of the flesh, the pleasure felt by the arahant reflecting on the release of his or her mind, the observations made above concerning how the steps in the other tetrads of breath meditation can be used to induce rapture apply to pleasure as well. Physically, steps 3 and 4. Mentally, step 10 would be gladdening the mind. And for the arahant, steps 12 to 16. Or that be steps 10 would be calming the mind.
Nine
is gladdening. Step 7 builds naturally on steps 5 and 6, because only when you have gained experience in inducing states of rapture and pleasure, so step 7 is the experiencing the citta sankhara, the mental formations. Step 7 builds naturally on steps 5 and 6 because only when you have gained experience in inducing states of rapture and pleasure and in observing the role of perception in conjunction with these states, can you see clearly the way their presence and absence can fabricate the state of your mind. This will enable you, in step 8, to calm the impact of these feelings and perceptions as seems appropriate. In other words, after inducing pleasure and rapture in the first two jhanas, you abandon the rapture in the second and the mental pleasure in the third, leading ultimately to the sense of non-affliction that comes from the equanimity of the fourth jhana, which Majjhima 13 describes as the highest allure of feelings. This equanimity then forms the basis for the formless attainments. The calming of mental fabrication as the mind goes through the jhanas echoes Majjhima 118, Anapanasati Sutta's description of the relationship between rapture and calm as factors for awakening. Unless the mind is already too energized, you have to make sure that it is energized before calming it. Otherwise, it will grow sluggish and constricted. And just a note in the sense, a note that I made as I was reading through that all of this, is that the way that he's presenting here is really kind of at the outer edge of the most refined, and it doesn't mean that if you're not experiencing fourth jhana after having competently and at ease gone through the first three jhanas and understood all the fabrications and whatnot, that you can't do anapanasati. Let's say these it's like a scale invariance in the sense that there's these processes that the Buddha laid down for cultivation, and we can be experiencing them at different levels and working through these different steps of anapanasati, and there's going to be a range of scale and experience that different people are going to experience, and certainly that whole spectrum of the 16 steps of anapanasati is just as applicable even when your mind is all over the place and under a full hindrance attack. You still sort of want to be trying to turn the direction to these skills and this practice, and you have a range of options available in terms of reflection and cultivation. Any other questions? Continue. There is an apparent contradiction in how some of the discourses describe the calming of feeling as you go through the third jhana to the fourth. On the one hand, as we just noted, the third jhana is marked by a state of physical pleasure and mental equanimity. The fourth jhana is described as purity of equanimity with neither pleasure nor pain. On the other hand, Anguttara 9, Sutta number 34, describes the act of attending to perceptions of equanimity as an affliction experienced in the third jhana that is abandoned in the fourth. And there's a quote from that sutta. So one enters and remains in the fourth jhana. If, as he remains there, he is beset with attention to perceptions dealing with equanimity, that is an affliction for him. And so that, and actually that would tend to bring the mind back down to third jhana. I mean, it would engage in that way again. So and the nature of the mind too, also Ajahn Chah would emphasize how the mind drops that recognition of perceptions and the directions of attentions and the states of mind that are experienced will be as they are perceived as more coarse, then they'll be relinquished and dropped, and the mind naturally moves towards something that's more refined.
fine.
The question is, if perceptions of equanimity are a disturbance in the fourth jhana, why is the fourth jhana described as a state of equanimity? This apparent contradiction can be resolved, however, by noting that the disturbance is not the equanimity itself, or even the mental labels about equanimity, but the act of attending to those labels. The equanimity present in the third jhana is something that distinguishes it from the second jhana, which is why it is an object of note at that level. In the fourth jhana, however, equanimity is no longer an object of note, and so there is no interest in attending to perceptions about it. This, of course, connects directly to the role of perception as a mental fabrication in steps 7 and 8. Several discourses provide more detailed information on the role of perception in fabricating calm for the mind. To begin with, Anguttara 3, Sutta 102, provides a general framework for understanding which perceptions need to be calmed in order to bring the mind to concentration, and then from lower levels of concentration to higher ones. And this is a quote from Anguttara 3, Sutta 102. When the meditator is rid of the gross impurities of misconduct in body, speech, and mind, there remain in him the moderate impurities, thoughts of sensuality, ill will, and harmfulness. These he abandons, destroys, dispels, wipes out of existence. When he is rid of them, there remains in him the fine impurities, thoughts of his caste, thoughts of his home district, thoughts related to not wanting to be despised. These he abandons, destroys, dispels, wipes out of existence. When he is rid of them, there remain only thoughts of the Dhamma. His concentration is neither peaceful nor exquisite, has not yet attained calm or unification, and is kept in place by the fabrication of forceful restraint. But there comes a time when his mind grows steady inwardly, settles down, grows unified and concentrated. His concentration is peaceful and exquisite, has attained calm and unification, and is no longer kept in place by the fabrication of forceful restraint. In other words, before you can bring the mind to concentration, you have to cleanse it of two sorts of perceptions: those related to sensuality, ill will, and harm on the one hand, and those related to your relationships with human society on the other. Then, once the mind has attained a lower stage of concentration, you have to further adjust your perceptions so that your concentration can grow more steady and unified, providing a more refined sense of well-being. Other discourses focus more on specific steps within this framework. Majjhima 78, for instance, focuses on how the role of perception in right resolve leads from the grosser mind states associated with sensuality to the more refined pleasure of the first jhana. So this is a quote from Majjhima 78. And what are unskillful resolves? Being resolved on sensuality, on ill will, on harmfulness. These are called unskillful resolves. What is the cause of unskillful resolves? Their cause too has been stated, and they are said to be perception caused. Which perception? For perception has many modes and permutations. Any sensuality perception, ill will perception, or harmfulness perception, that is the cause of unskillful resolves. Now, where do unskillful resolves cease without trace? Their cessation, too, has been stated. There is the case where a monk, quite secluded from sensuality, secluded from unskillful qualities, enters and remains in the first jhana. Rapture and pleasure born of seclusion, accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. This is where unskillful resolves cease without trace. And what sort of practice is the practice leading to the cessation of unskillful resolves? There is the case where a monk generates desire for the sake for the sake of non-arising of evil, unskillful qualities that have not yet arisen, for the sake of abandoning evil, unskillful qualities that have arisen, for the sake of the arising of skillful qualities that have not yet arisen, and for the development and culmination of skillful qualities that have arisen. This sort of practice is the practice leading to the cessation of unskillful resolves. So that's the classic definition of right effort. In other words, you use perceptions that induce desire for skillful states to undercut unskillful perceptions. One way of undercutting the perceptions leading to wrong resolve is to cultivate perceptions that highlight the drawbacks of sensuality. Majjhima 54 provides a useful list of similes to help generate perceptions of this sort. So this is all from Majjhima 54. Suppose a dog overcome with weakness and hunger were to come across a slaughterhouse, and there a dexterous butcher or butcher's apprentice were to fling him a chain of bones, thoroughly scraped without any meat, smeared with blood. What do you think? Would the dog gnawing on that chain of bones, thoroughly scraped without any meat, smeared with blood, appease its weakness and hunger? No, Lord. And why is that? Because the chain of bones is thoroughly scraped without any meat and smeared with blood. The dog would get nothing but its share of weariness and vexation. In the same way, householder, a disciple of the Noble Ones considers this point. The Blessed One has compared sensuality to a chain of bones of much stress, much despair, and greater drawbacks. Now suppose a vulture, a kite, or a hawk, seizing a lump of meat, were to take off, and other vultures, kites, or hawks, following right after it, were to tear at it with their beaks and pull at it with their claws. What do you think? If that vulture, kite, or hawk were not quickly to drop that lump of meat, would it meet with death from that cause or with death-like pain? Yes, Lord. In the same way, householder, a disciple of the Noble Ones considers this point. The Blessed One has compared sensuality to a lump of meat of much stress, much despair, and greater drawbacks. Now suppose a man were to come against the wind, carrying a burning grass torch. What do you think? If he were to not quickly drop that grass torch, would he burn his hand or his arm or some other part of his body, so that he would meet with death from that cause or with death-like pain? Yes, Lord. In the same way, householder, a disciple of the Noble Ones considers this point. The Blessed One has compared sensuality to a grass torch of much stress, much despair, and greater drawbacks. Now suppose there were a pit of glowing embers, deeper than a man's height, full of embers that were neither flaming nor smoking. And a man were to come along, loving life, hating death, loving pleasure, abhorring pain, and two strong men, grabbing him with their arms, were to drag him to the pit of embers. What do you think? Wouldn't the man twist his body this way and that? Yes, Lord. And why is that? Because he would realize, if I fall into this pit of glowing embers, I will meet with death from that cause or with death-like pain. In the same way, householder, a disciple of the Noble Ones considers this point. The Blessed One has compared sensuality to a pit of glowing embers, of much stress, much despair, and greater drawbacks. Now suppose a man, when dreaming, were to see delightful parks, delightful forests, delightful stretches of land, and delightful lakes, and on awakening were to see nothing. In the same way, householder, a disciple of the Noble Ones, considers this point. The Blessed One has compared sensuality to a dream of much stress, much despair, and greater drawbacks. Now suppose a man having borrowed some goods, a carriage, fine jewels, and ear ornaments, were to go into the market preceded and surrounded by his borrowed goods. And people seeing him would say, "How wealthy this man is, for this is how the wealthy enjoy their possessions." But the actual owners, wherever they might see him, would strip him then and there of what is theirs. What do you think? Would the man justifiably be upset? No, Lord. And why is that? Because the owners are stripping him of what is theirs. And in the same way, householder, a disciple of the noble ones considers this point. The Blessed One has compared sensuality to borrowed goods of much stress, much despair, and greater drawbacks. Now suppose that, not far from a village or town, there were a dense forest grove, and there in the grove was a tree with delicious fruit, abundant fruit, but with no fruit fallen to the ground. A man would come along desiring fruit, looking for fruit, searching for fruit. Plunging into the forest grove, he would see the tree, and the thought would occur to him, "This is a tree with delicious fruit, abundant fruit, and there is no fruit fallen to the ground, but I know how to climb a tree. Why don't I climb the tree, eat what I like, and fill my clothes with the fruit?" So, having climbed the tree, he would eat what he liked and filled his clothes with the fruit. Then a second man would come along, desiring fruit, looking for fruit, searching for fruit, and carrying a sharp axe. Plunging into the forest grove, he would see the tree, and the thought would occur to him, "This is a tree with delicious fruit, abundant fruit, and there is no fruit fallen to the ground, and I don't know how to climb a tree. Why don't I chop down this tree at the root, eat what I like, and fill my clothes with the fruit?" So he would chop the tree at the root. What do you think? If the first man who climbed the tree didn't quickly come down, wouldn't the falling tree crush his hand or foot or some other part of his body so that he would meet with death and from that cause or with death-like pain? Yes, Lord. In the same way, householder, a disciple of the noble ones considers this point. The Blessed One has compared sensuality to the fruits of a tree of much stress, much despair, and greater drawbacks. However, Majjhima 78 does not stop with the role of perception in supporting skillful resolves. It also shows how perception, in this case, the perception of whatever theme leads the mind to the second jhana, can be used in moving beyond even the subtle disturbance of thinking associated with right resolve. And this continues, Majjhima 78. And what are skillful resolves? Being resolved on renunciation, that is, freedom from sensuality, on non-ill will, on harmlessness. These are called skillful resolves. What is the cause of skillful resolves? Their cause, too, has been stated, and they are said to be perception-caused. Which perception? For perception has many modes and permutations. Any renunciation perception, non-ill will perception, or harmlessness perception, that is the cause of skillful resolves. Now, where do skillful resolves cease without trace? Their cessation, too, has been stated. There is the case where a monk, with the stilling of directed thoughts and evaluations, enters and remains in the second jhana. Rapture and pleasure born of concentration, unification of awareness, free from directed thought and evaluation. Internal assurance. This is where skillful resolves cease without trace. And what sort of practice is the practice leading to the cessation of skillful resolves? There is the case where a monk generates desire, and going through the formula of right effort, for the sake of the non-arising of evil unskillful qualities that have not yet arisen, for the sake of abandoning of evil unskillful qualities that have arisen, for the sake of arising of skillful qualities that have not yet arisen, and for the development and cultivation of skillful qualities that have arisen. This sort of practice is the practice leading to the cessation of skillful resolves. This is one of the ways in which calming the mental fabrication caused by perception stops even the activity of right resolve, leading to a steadier state of concentration. Okay, how are we doing? Any questions?
Yeah. I had a question. I was wondering if you could explain the analogy involving the emperors.
Uh-huh.
I wasn't sure what I was referring to. Was it just certainly sensuality is painful, or
Sensuality is painful. It doesn't live up to its advertising. the unfortunate allure is its or its promise is that it's actually going to really it's really going to solve everything, and then in the end one is left, yeah, it's kind of, it's at the especially when you're speaking about both refined states of concentration as well as the liberated mind, then your sensual pleasure is very disturbing, and you can't hardly believe that from the point of view of an ordinary state of mind, which is why it's so important to be encouraging the mind to develop as much calm and clarity and stability, because it really changes the perception of how we experience things. Where the heck is that? I'm trying to think how the Buddha phrased that. But just the sense that for one who hasn't experienced anything more than that, pleasant feeling is the only release from suffering. I can't remember the sutta where it is. It's later on in the Majjhima Nikaya, toward the. But I can't remember exactly. But that's very much the case. Where, the only sort of relief that one gets from dukkha is the seeking some kind of sensual gratification, sensual pleasure. And it isn't as if it's not pleasurable, but it is pleasurable from the measuring point of a worldly mind, and without having seen that there's something beyond that. Yeah.
So as a householder, dealing with sensual pleasure, more mindfulness and calmness.
Yeah. I mean, it's. The reality is that as a householder, then one is exposed to the whole realm, but then in the same way that one is just seeing the drawback, and then that cultivation of more, because there's the well-being that arises from just from virtue and integrity, and the pleasure that arises from generosity and selflessness. Those are tangible. Those are not pleasure derived from sensual pleasure. Those are pleasure derived from the skillful, the wholesome, and then you get a feel for it. Wow, if it's this much, I wonder what it'd be like for them. And then it's then the mind is, you one encourages oneself in that way. Yeah.
Ajahn Sirpano suggested that a way to interpret that simile of the two men dragging the other towards that charcoal pit in regards to sensuality is that if you've got desire pulling you to something really unskillful,
you had better struggle against it. Otherwise, you're really in for it.
Right. Yes, yes. This is a reality.
Yeah, the one that comes to mind is the leper burning his
right,
lesions. And yeah. That feels good.
That feels really good.
But then when his lesions are healed, it doesn't.
Yeah, it's just, then they start dropping, the various digits start dropping off. there goes another one. Well, it's like, you know, how good it feels to scratch poison oak. That's really not a good thing to do.
Scratched on your skin. The other thought that just came to mind when we were reading that was just how that nicely kind of also underscores that, you know, working towards states of absorption and deep concentration don't require just, you know, the breathing meditation, that you can use objects like renunciation.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
Objects.
Yeah, I mean, those are skillful. I mean, they're unpacking the the four tetrads, but inevitably you have to sort of do that sequentially, and I think that's where, especially that in the next tetrad with gladdening the mind. Is an opportunity to pick up different, if necessary, pick up different themes or pick up different perceptions, pick up different associations, and that help the mind to direct itself to uplift and brightness.
I just wanted to add one comment to Mariah's question. Something you said that I also experience a lot of, especially being monastery, is just sympathetic joy. Like just seeing other people be kind and generous. It's really remarkable how much pleasure can come from just that.
Yeah.
Just, you know, that doesn't really require very much work.
That's one of the best ways of doing it. If you get, you know, other people do good things, then you just delight in it.
I found that too, just seeing the lay people coming and like saying hi to each other, being harmonious, gives a lot of joy.
Okay, sit quietly for a bit.